For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record. For the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right.
Welcome back to The Clink. This season, we're hearing from inspirational women, and this week, it's part two of the Sandy Jessamine story. She's an amazing woman with such a big personality, and I tell you now, she's got some brilliant stories. And I hope that you enjoy part two of this episode, Stories of Redemption.
Then I arrive at Kambala, which no one knew existed at the time. It was these creepy old buildings and you could feel the sorrow ooze off them. It was creepy, was brand new. Kambala, you could just feel this history there, all this tragedy. So I arrive at this institution, superintendent and this officer. Hello, it's really nice to meet you. We hope you'll be happy here and you've been selected. And
selected? I thought, oh, you won the lottery.
And I'm thinking, what is going on? Because, you know, officers never said shit like that. You didn't get officers go, welcome, it's so nice to see you.
Yep.
And it's really good you're here. And so I had no idea why I was sent there.
When you say Hay had been shut down and the other places, was that because of inquiries and was that because of the bad things that had happened there, or was it just the government just making a small move to close another centre in a nice way?
No, it definitely wasn't. This officer was rabbiting on about feminists, which I'd never heard of, because the media and women's organisations became aware of the brutality at Parramatta Girls Home and Hay. I was actually locked in Ormond when it was on, I think, one of the TV shows, you know, Today Tonight. I can't remember. But so a lot of people had protested out of outside Parramatta Girls Home about brutality and archaic practices. I'm not sure that was a factor in it, but so what they did, they opened an alternative institution, Reby, at Campbelltown.
Yes, okay.
And started to send the girls there and closed Hay altogether.
Yep.
Now they had the issue of what to do with girls who would have normally gone to Hay.
Yes.
So Reby, Kambala didn't replace Parramatta Girls Home. It was just located there. Reby replaced it. It had hundreds of young girls who would have been at Parramatta Girls Home. Kambala was the replacement to Hay, but it was the total opposite.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare for me. Eventually they went, we're going to take the wildest, the most troublesome girls in institutions who can't complete their time or have severe emotional problems, and we're going to open Kambala Special Unit.
Yep.
It was an amazing experiment that they didn't learn from. They said, what we're going to do is we're going to be really nice to these kids. The staff are going to try and get to know them, form relationships. We're going to teach them life skills. We're going to involve them in their own case management. But out of hundreds of girls across the home, it's only, you know, 12 at most at Kambala when I was there, not at the same time. So I had no idea what was happening when I arrived. And it's a shame it hasn't carried through, because the government went, what would happen if we were nice to these kids?
Mm.
What would happen if we took the wildest kids in custody, girls, and we actually really treated them like human beings, not at Reby, which was basically like Parramatta Girls Home or
Ormond.
What would happen? Let's have a social experiment to see what happens with these young girls.
If we reverse the roles and make it all sort of, you know, nice.
Yeah, but the problem was they were so nice that they actually put a picnic table and chairs against the wall. So what we did, we put the picnic tables on top of the chair and sconded over it. Mass breakout.
Holy.
What
You took their kindness as weakness.
No. We just suddenly went, oh, my goodness, they put a table and chairs against the wall. We can escape. And so once you get the idea, we all had histories of attempted escapes. So it was that easy.
Wow.
It was just, so my first few weeks there was great. They even had a Christmas concert with a band for about 7-8 girls. And, you know, it was a really, really
livable.
Nice place. It was really, I mean, the officers sat at the tables with us and counted knives and forks. What happened during this escape, this young girl who looked similar to me, I think she was much prettier personally, but, you know, we looked similar.
Yeah.
She was 17 by then. When I arrived at Kambala, I was put in a room with her. There was only two other girls there. And one was a young Aboriginal girl who'd been in and out since she was 12 on the streets, you know, from around Redfern.
Yep.
And there was this other girl who had been sentenced for murder at 14. So they put me, she was 17 by then, they put me in a room with her. And I'll never forget my first night, because here I am charged with uncontrollable.
Mm.
And my roommate is someone who's murdered someone in their sleep.
Wow.
So I didn't sleep well that night, needless to say, but she was very personable, this girl, very charismatic, and I became friends with her as the other girls did. But what happened during this escape, four of us, not her, escaped over the wall, so the four of us just jumped over impulsively.
Yeah.
My Christmas, I hadn't heard from my family. The Christmas presents had accidentally gone to the psychiatric centre. It was 27th of December 1974, and I thought my family, even, you know, my grandmother had totally disowned me, unaware that, you know, mail just was going to the wrong place. So four of us jumped over this wall and swam the river and broke into a house and stole clothes and a lot of unnecessary stuff. I don't know what we thought we were going to do with it. So we're walking down the main street round Northmead, and we look across the road, and here's this other girl who'd been convicted of murder. You know, we were all in for exposed to moral danger, minor things. And I call her Kelly in my book. So suddenly there's five of us on the run, and our escape was front page news next to Cyclone Tracy, which happened at the time. And we were suddenly caught up in a, you know, Australia-wide police hunt, because they desperately wanted this girl back in custody.
Yeah.
And
do you think, too, that they were concerned about her influence over you girls as well, whilst you were all on the run?
She didn't have a lot of influence, ironically. She'd been locked up since she was 14, so she was thrown into King's. She'd very middle-class girl. She was suddenly thrown. We followed the young Aboriginal girl's lead. She took us to the cross, and the rest of us were a bit lost out there. But but they did. They were concerned that they immediately branded her. She was the ringleader, the cause of this. They didn't care about us. They just wanted her caught, you know, dangerous escapee. And the irony is they did catch us and they let us go, the police.
Really?
Really.
All of you, or just like, obviously not her, not the one that they...
Her.
As well.
Well, what happened is we actually did look alike. I was shorter.
Yeah.
But we actually did look a hell of a lot alike, and we dyed our hair jet black. And
I've seen that in the paper clipping that you sent me. There was, I was actually sitting there thinking when you're saying before about being blonde, I'm thinking, she had black hair, but now I understand why.
Crew cut, jet black hair. So we looked even more alike. We decided our disguise, we were going to be twins. Didn't matter. She was a bit taller, and we were going to be twins. So, I mean, we holed up at the cross. Then we went to her parents' house. I'll never forget those poor people. Hi, Mum and Dad, I'm home.
No.
By then, three of us in tow, and the police were outside. We hidden under the bed.
Yeah.
Parents desperately want us to hand ourselves in. She said no. please go. They give us some money. We go to Luna Park and we're having a great time going on all the rides.
Wow.
And went back to the cross and we got a ride to Melbourne. So there's four of us heading to Melbourne and the police pulled the driver over. He was speeding, took us into the police station and we all had bodgy stories. And her and I were twins. You know, we're twins and we're from, we had some address. I think it was Mount Druitt, can't remember. We had our stories. And the cop's on the phone, yeah, got four girls with them. Two are twins. Yeah, yeah, you're like, yeah, definitely, you know, twins.
Bar, so then it basically bar. Counted out the one woman that they were looking for.
Totally.
She wasn't there.
Anyway, he comes back out and he says to the driver, sorry, mate, we've got to keep you. You've got warrants. The rest of you can go. And there was another guy and he said, I'm not driving you to Melbourne after this, girls. I'm heading back to Sydney.
Yeah, wow.
So we went back to Sydney and what happened then, she said, look, we've got to split up because they may realise their escape if the Kambala officers said, look, they do look alike, these girls.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was so funny. The police, you can go, see you later. So we split up. What happened then was one of the other girls and I, we didn't know what to do. I remember it was, I think it was the 30th of December around Christmas. We had nowhere to go. You know, we really, we were locked up, but we weren't streetwise kids.
Yeah. Yep.
So we're roaming around late at night. I convinced her to ring her parents to see if they'd put us up in the night. And I'm sure we were somewhere around Liverpool. So yep. She'd gone back to mum and dad. Oh, I'm going back to mum and dad. Might have, you know, Christmas turkey left over. And, you know, so she headed back to her parents' house with one of the girls. And the other one and I, she wanted to go to the cross. I refused. We'd met a young prostitute who decided two of us could, you know, make a bit of money to fund our escape.
Yep.
I was one of them and refused, and the other girl. So we weren't going back near her. Anyway, we're in a phone booth, you know, making a reverse charge call to this girl's parents. This is so clear in my memory. Cop car goes back, drives past, comes back, hangs up the phone, picked us up, threw us in the police car. And they seemed to have an idea of who we were. I think, yeah, someone had seen us. So we cheeked. I had no idea where they took us, but we cheeked them all away. You know, young girls, not having a clue, cheeked them. I still remember being taken into an office. Some detective, there's ashtrays, and it's like I can be in the room and remember what direction I'm facing, and I can see this detective and these police behind us.
Did they have the old telephone book sitting on the desk?
They had phone books, but what we did, we knocked them off. I knocked all their files off. I was giving them a mouthful of cheek. She knocked the phone.
Oh, dear.
We were just being, you know, smart ass. We're, you know, tough little runaways.
Yeah.
Neither of us were. So I remember they took us to the cells and there was a whole heap of them. I had no idea what was going to happen. They separated. They took her into one cell. They took me into another cell.
Is this at the old SPC, the old Sydney Police Centre?
I had no idea. Or Central. It was, we were dead tired.
Yeah.
I had no idea Sydney at the time, so I can't, all I remember is the phone booth, the drive taken. Anyway, the police took me into a cell. They said, hands in front of you. They handcuffed me in front. One grabbed that shoulder. I can't remember which, but I remember I can sort of see sometimes this direction of the wall. One pinned me to a wall with one shoulder, one to the other. The other grabbed hold of my head. You know, his hands were around my ears and suddenly went smash. And I was in shock and I went back.
Smacked your head into the wall?
Well, the back of my head, smashed it in.
Wow.
And what happened, I remember like seeing stars and they knocked me out cold. it was, you know, when you have that horror moment of knowing what's happened. So they literally knocked me unconscious, this 15-year-old kid. And I came to, and I remember I was on a mattress by then, and the cop came in and put his shoes, booting in my face, and he said, "Where's this girl? You know, that's why they beat us. Where is she?"
They wanted, yeah, they wanted the main perpetrator that they were hunting.
They wanted her, couldn't care.
Yeah.
So I, and at that point I decided, now as an adult, I would have told anyone where this girl was. As a 15-year-old kid, somehow I wasn't giving him, I don't know where she was. So he put his shoe in my face and he kept it there and I couldn't back away. But I didn't at the time tell him. And then he just went out and shut the door. And when I came to next time, the other girl was on the same mattress as me and she'd been beaten in the other cell. What happened? All sorts of procedures were missed. And when I checked my records, it was bizarre. Normally you're taken to Minda, you know, if you escape or you're taken to Minda. Well, Minda wouldn't have us. They were worried they'd get the five Kambala girls. And we were seen as like the Hay girls.
Well, Minda was maximum security for males as well back then, juvenile males. It was a very secure place.
But they didn't want these five girls there at the same time, obviously. They were really worried about, because Kambala was seen as Hay girl. Mm. So we were taken 31st of December, taken to Albion Street Court. I was in a fog. I think I just was still head. I think I had a head injury, to be honest. It was like a nightmare. So he just sentenced us for absconding, not the break and enter. The girl and I were taken back to Kambala. And my memory is really foggy. I thought we were put in isolation, but it wasn't in my records at all. So I got confused. But what actually happened when we went back, I was in this, we tried to get the Kambala superintendent and the officers to charge the police. I didn't think that was possible. She did. She, you know, had criminal connections and we're going to charge him. And he's no, you know, covered in bruises and righty-right. So, and then we were barred from talking about it. So I'd been knocked unconscious. I was in some sort of fugue, horrific state when I went back.
Yeah.
Anyway, soon after, a friend of mine came from Minda, a girl I was close to, and the girl who was beaten with me decided to hate my guts. You know, my other friend, girls hate each other for odd reasons. She felt rejected, obviously. So she blamed me. You know, this young killer was caught because you told the cops. I'm tough. I wouldn't do it. You told the cops and now she got caught and now she's going to prison and it's all your fault. Mm-hmm. Well, as you would know, you know, lagging's the kiss of death.
Yep. There is no do. Do not do.
So I had a mental breakdown. I think I had a head injury, to be honest. And it was just a really, you know, I couldn't make sense of the fact that I'd just been, my fear was being trapped and being pinned. And I'd had a nightmare that this was happening about when I, you know, had first met this, seen this girl on the news that I was going to be pinned and horrible things. And I'd just been, you know, for a 15-year-old girl who hasn't been in that criminal world or experienced that, the worst thing was a lot of girls in custody had told me they'd been raped in paddy wagons and some smart-ass coppers have made some comment about us smelling bad or groping. And I can't remember what word for word he said, but a lot of girls had experienced police violence. It was almost a norm. If they were powerless girls who were on the streets,
had no
girls,
one to back them up, or family or money or anything. Yeah.
Poor families. Yeah. They were poor families.
No one would care.
Criminal families.
Yeah.
So I had never experienced this. And suddenly here was this murderer who was quite nice in her crimes were horrific, don't get me wrong there, but and here were these cops who pinned young girls to walls and smashed their head into it and beat them unconscious. And at that time I just wound up, now I realized it was chronic PTSD. I had a total breakdown, and in that state I began to switch again, you know, between child states and wildcat state.
Yep.
And the other girls knew. There was only a few of us in there. So I wound up being a target then. You know, I was trying to fight off other girls and no one would speak to me. And what got me through in Windsor, one of our neighbours had been an Aboriginal woman two doors up who'd looked after us up school, and she was my only visitor. You know, she visited me at Reeby. She came in and she saw I was in a really bad way. And she started to come regularly, even told me I could live with her family when I got out.
So genuinely checking in on your well-being and making sure that you were safe, I guess.
Yeah, she had no idea of the extent of the bullying.
Yeah.
At Reeby, I left with a big bag of love letters from other girls. I had
love. You and your friends. Love letters.
I was
kind of cute.
At Tambala, I was getting, you know, spat on and smacked around, and I could physically fight, but not the undercurrents.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, yeah, it was at that breakdown I described at the start when I worked with the corrupt cops in prison, it was identical. Two breakdowns 40 years apart that both were linked. You know, that one I'd been beaten unconscious by police. Suddenly, 40 years later, I'm the teacher carrying the prison keys and the corrupt cops are my students and I'm helping them write life stories. It was like someone got an hourglass, tipped it upside down. And this strange reality. So
how old were you when you stopped, sort of when the whole locking up? Because you never went to adult prison as such, did you?
No.
So, yeah, there must have been a period. Let's talk about moving forward a little bit to, say, you know, young adolescence, meaning young adulthood. Because there's got to be some sort of big void there from you to go from that to jumping out to spending so many years helping people in the same scenarios that you once were in.
Like, I did escape two more times and then I was released at 16. I lived with this Aboriginal woman. I won't go into the second escape because the other escapes because they're, you know, I wound up being raped and it was pretty horrific.
Okay.
But I got out. I survived Kambala. I came out of it and I was no longer this naive little girl with long blonde plaits. So I was this pretty streetwise.
Yeah, definitely streetwise.
But I still had a part of me that shoplifted when I got out. And ironically, I got caught again. I was living with this Aboriginal woman. This is the Sandy I was trying to describe in there.
Yeah.
I rock up in court, shoplifting. I've just got out of this home. I'm in jeans, a sloppy Joe. He magistrate sentenced me, remanded me into custody. My Aboriginal
flatmate.
You know, she was just lovely. I mean,
so this is the same wonderful Indigenous woman that was looking after you and looking out for you that whole period. So when you speak of her, you're speaking of this wonderful woman that had been a part of your journey, I guess.
Yeah, through who, you know, been this massive support. So she bailed me out and she said, Sandy, you've got to get it together or you're going to go back to that place because it was impulsive. So I went, okay. So I start looking for work in the city, land a job in a solicitor's office in Martin Place, you know, as a male girl. But so I'm suddenly, so I get a job, I'm the male girl in a solicitor's office, buy myself a suit, got them to write a reference. They didn't know it was for a magistrate. Rock back in court a month later and I'm in my suit and I'm working for a solicitor.
I had no idea. Oh my gosh.
I know.
Oh, wow. Now, see, that's streetwise right there. That's thinking. Thinking on your feet. That's clever. I like that. That's Went and had a job. Went from escapee and no trouble person to working in a solicitor's firm, getting a reference. That's gold,
yeah.
Sandy. I rate that highly. That's probably one of the best that I've heard. And I've heard some bloody good stories on the clink, I can tell you. That's a good one.
And so that was the end. Never got locked up again.
Wow.
I didn't plan to work in prison, so I'd never planned to.
Well, this is the funny thing. Well, it's not funny, actually. Did you stay in and around the law firms? Like, is that what
No. I paid paid off my fine at 16. Went to Wagga, visited my family for a couple of months, and spent a year hitchhiking around Australia by myself, working at roadhouses, going on prawn trawlers.
How good's that?
I mean, I had no fear of being on the highway by myself compared to being locked up with a pack of girls who hated me and being in a cell beaten by police. Didn't matter if it was midnight.
Yep. I can understand.
Yeah. I developed streetwise what cars to get in. I got work easily. I was presentable. I worked in Criterion Pub in Perth, lied about my age, said I was 18.
You were quite smart, weren't you? Like, all jokes aside, you were quite an intelligent young woman. You know, I listened to how you're telling your story, and it takes someone with half a bit of nous to be able to do the things or think in the way that you did, you know, to get yourself where you needed to be and just, you know, survival daily. I'm impressed.
Have a sip of water. Yeah, at my core, I think there was a survivor, and I was aware, because mentally I could tip over the edge, I was aware of not going near the edge. And the year I hitchhiked around Australia, it was wonderful. I was up on Darwin in a commune, and there was travellers from all over the world. So it really broadened my outlook in a way.
Yeah.
I was independent, and then I got pregnant. That changed it, but yeah.
When you say you got pregnant, if I may ask, how many children do you have?
I've got four. One daughter, like I said, died of a drug overdose in 2015. I married someone who picked me up hitching, a Vietnam vet. Now, isn't that a great conversation? A kid who's been locked in institutions and has all this PTSD, and a Vietnam vet who brings in his own PTSD and experienced.
Goodness. And how old were you now? What were you, 19, 20?
18.
18, yeah. And how old was he?
He was 10 years older.
Wow.
So I've been hitching, and it ended up being a violent marriage that I escaped from.
You ended up marrying him?
Ended up marrying him. We had a couple of kids. He was Catholic. He wanted him Christian Catholic, which I didn't care. Like I said, so we went up. We're in a little town, and he said to the priest, "Can we get the kids christened?" The priest, who was later was a pedophile who hung himself. You'll find his name.
That's a job well done.
Yeah. Ever thought of getting
Bravo
married?
Bravo to him.
He said, "Ever thought of being married?" And I said, "I don't really care." So we got married one day, and the kids christened the next. So I got out of that marriage at 24, and I had three kids. I took them all, but the oldest, the little boy who was six at the time, I had to send him back through the court for holidays, and he just was never returned to me. And by then I'd moved interstate and all sorts of things, so he ended up raising my son. I raised the two girls, and later in another relationship, I've got a son with autism. I had him when the youngest of those was 15.
You went to university?
Oh, yeah, I got a master's.
As well as raising children, and I don't want to be rude, but were you a single mum at that stage as well?
Yeah. Wow. In housing commission.
Wow.
And then working in needle exchanges.
Are you kidding me?
No. Lived in Woolloomooloo, housing state. When it was Raffer's Guts, Elgar Street. Oh, my God, in the 80s, that was a shock to the system. So I've left the hubby. I've got the two girls. Yeah, I wound up in women's refuges.
Yep.
had a bout of bulimia too around that time, I think, which never had again. So I wound up in a psych hospital for 2 months. My parents looked after the girls. Came out of that and was fine, you know. Wound up in a women's refuge in Sydney, Elsie's. And this is the mid-80s. So I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. Elsie's was run by feminist women. Bra-burners. You know, that's how I thought of it till then. I was in a little mining town, married, wearing miniskirts and working at the workers' club. So I wind up in Elsie Women's Refuge. And suddenly, you know, women were saying, Sandy, this DB is not, you know, they were actually really vocal about women's rights. So I was suddenly exposed to that feminist culture in my 20s. And must say, it turned my life around, because my young experiences, and I'm telling this to a bloke, but yeah, you know, so suddenly I'm in the women's refuge and I'm marching down the street, 2, 4, 6, 8, dead men don't rape, you know, and reclaim the night marches and, you know, had some.
Yeah, but hang on. With from your point of view and your story, with, you know, absolute compassion for what you were saying. I mean, you're a survivor.
Yeah.
So you had every right to walk those streets and you know, proudly stand up and know that you're supported by other women, feminists, whatever you will, you know. I think that's a really lovely thing that you were given that connection to be able to voice, instead of being, you know, that young little blonde lady or girl contained, you were able to finally speak out.
Well, when I was raped on one of my escapes from Kambala, I had no voice. So I didn't tell anyone because I thought I would be blamed because I'd, you know, had consensual sex with one boy and then was raped by an older man. And I actually, as a girl, I thought, well, who, you know, I walked into a house, men took my clothes, I've had sex with one and got raped. Can you imagine that going to court in the 70s? Yeah. So I shut up and I buried all this horrific terror and pain. What I did do after that is I ran screaming through the streets. And now I know, having taught loads of stress management, yoga teacher, that if you, even though it was horrific, if you run screaming and you were just running and running and running and you were screaming and screaming and screaming, you're actually healing your body of something.
Whereas I do that out in the ocean. I get out in the ocean and one for you, actually. That's funny you say that. I was the first in the world to cycle across Australia in 45 days from the Gold Coast at Snapper Rocks to Cottesloe Beach in Perth.
I know Cottesloe Beach.
Yes, that was where I stopped. Yeah. So 2016, I did that, and I was the first person to do that, 4,564 kilometres. And people were saying, how did you get across the Nullarbor? So there was one man who sat at an average of about 30 k's a kilometre in front of me while I was cycling with the, you know, flashing lights. Behind me while I was cycling with the flashing lights and what have you. And, you know, I got to the point where it was cold, it was miserable, and I didn't fucking care. I was so headstrong about what I was trying to achieve, and I was just taking in this beautiful, and everyone says, oh, man, it's long, it's boring. There's so much beauty, and at that 25, 30 k's an hour, you see everything. I've seen birds in trees that had these sacks that were nests. I've seen things that you just would blink and miss, you know, in a car at 100 plus kilometres an hour. Yeah. What I also didn't do was suppress any of my pain any longer. I rode and I screamed like I'll never forget it on this stretch. And I had my headphones in and my song, and I was playing and the music stopped. And I burst into just tears. I don't know whether it was joy that I'd got onto the Nullarbor, that I just was doing this. I was halfway almost at Kimber. Like, and I screamed and I screamed and I screamed. And I feel I need to probably do that, because it was 2016, it's now 2021. I need to fucking go and scream again, because life's just built up again. But it works.
It works. And I think that's why, after the police beating, I had no voice. I was pinned. I was in a cell. After the rape, you know, on the escape, I ran and I screamed and I came back into my body and I was able to move on from that. Did you stop at Cocklebitty in the Nullarbor?
I did. I did, yes.
I worked
absolutely.
There.
Well, I went straight across. So I went from Dubbo up to down Dubbo to Broken Hill, from Broken Hill up and across, and basically onto the Nullarbor that way through South Australia. And yeah, I did all the way across. And I've been a long haul truck driver too for years. So prior to me now obviously working home doing my podcast, I would do remote Australia. So I'd do, you know, 18,000 kilometres, do two trips around Australia pretty much in a month working away driving semis. So I love it. I love when you mentioned earlier about, you know, being out here and there and just getting out and hitchhiking. I thought, fuck, I love it. Cocklebitty.
The Nullarbor. I had a truckie who was taking me to Perth from South Australia.
Yes.
Married man, rabbit and honour. Yeah. Anyway, he put the hard word on me, put his hand in the leg. We're on the Nullarbor Plains, fork it or walk it, a girl.
No route, no ride, I think was the thing back there.
Yeah, well, I was, you know, I was a pretty street. Well, I knew to get out of there, that car. Anyway, and I told him to fuck off.
Yep.
You know, I wasn't this naive young. Anyway, he screeched to a stop, then grabbed my duffel bag and got out and abused the crap out of him. Off he goes. So I'm in the Nullarbor Plains in the middle of nowhere, a 17-year-old girl by myself, walking along with my duffel bag.
That's scary.
And I felt wonderful, singing seeker songs and dancing along the along the highway there. This old guy in a ute, Puck comes and he goes, "What's a young girl like you doing alone in the desert? I thought you was a cow."
Oh.
And he took me to Nullarbor and they gave me a waitressing job.
Really? At the Roadhouse?
Yeah, I worked there for a few months.
At Nullarbor Roadhouse itself?
Cocklebitty Roadhouse.
Cocklebitty. That's up on the bend there, isn't it? Just before the lookout. It's where the golf course is. They've got a golf course thing on there now. You can go. Not green. It's not green. It is just like the desert. But you can go and you can play golf from one part of the Nullarbor to other. It's the longest golf course, par three or four, whatever. And look, there's a fucking golf course in the middle of nowhere out there. It's just desert. It's just dirt. But you hire the golf clubs and you play golf.
That's bizarre. What we used to do near Cocklebitty, there were some underground caves and they were all pink coral.
Mm.
And, you know, whoever had a car would drive us out to these caves. The water was crystal clear.
Yep.
And we'd swim in them. But that's way off track. But, yeah, so that was 17, you know, 18. Great year, hitching around Australia.
How good.
But you wanted to know about the marching, the feminists and the marching the street.
Well, I mean, it's important. It's an important part of your journey, definitely.
Well, I'd come out of this marriage where I was in a coal mining town, you know, working at the workers' club miniskirts, and came out of, you know, quite a violent situation. And I was trapped because I had little kids. And it's hard. So I wound up somehow in Elsie Women's Refuge in Sydney. And for the first time, I was getting a lot of, you know, in that town, I tried to speak up. You know, I actually really did try, but you couldn't. It was just the norm. It was all these beaten women. So suddenly in my 20s, mid-20s, around 25, I was getting angry and marching the street, and I was pretty wild. I was carting the kids off to music festivals, and the workers at Elsie's, you know, it wasn't the traditional women's roles I'd seen. It was this wild, free ride. But anyway, I wound up in public housing in Elgar Street, Glebe Estate, and it was the roughest place I've ever been. I mean, apart from the homes. And I remember they gave me the key to, and I went up the next day and I said, "I can't live here. All the guys, you know, there's so much drugs, alcohol, all the guys had been in jail." They said, "Oh, well, give us the keys and go." They said, "We're not giving you another place."
Yeah.
So a miracle happened, which didn't seem a miracle at the time. So I went through quite a rough time there, but I went to TAFE and did some general ed study and did really well. But it was just, you know, basic. I can remember them saying, "Gosh, you've got quite a brain. You've just topped this." And I think, "Oh, yeah." So I was, but in the 20s, recreational drug use, never addiction, you know, for kids. But, you know, leaving the kids with relatives and friends and living a bit of a wild life in my mid-20s. And then the shit hit the fan and it changed my life. And do you want to hear about the shit hitting the fan?
Why not?
Boyfriend had used to sail, you know, who's staying with me, used to sail boats, you know, Des Moines Sailing Club, you know, go and race them and that, had a skiff. Anyway, he put the sail of the boat in my bathroom and they were old housing commission and they had these, you know, the gas heaters on showers where there's an open flame.
Yes, I do.
And it's above the shower.
You used to sit, or in the laundry, just on the back of the shower wall.
Yeah. Bloody danger, especially with a boat. Anyway, so the kids were gone. I took a couple of Rohypnol. So I wasn't a drug user. But, someone gave them to me. Oh, you know, this would be cruising. So,
do you remember anything?
Yeah, I do. The toilet exploding. So what happens, it's middle of the night. I'm blissfully in this Rohypnol sleep and suddenly there's an explosion and what had happened is the wind had blown the sail against the gas heater.
Oh, no.
It exploded and the toilet exploded and went
So
I wake up, literally the shit hit the fan, the toilet exploded. I'm out of it. I roam out of there, the place is on fire, knock on, bashing on the neighbor's door, still totally and she's going, behind you. Anyway, I just remember it was like a comedy act. The woman upstairs, this is Elgar Street, the fire brigade came and some media and they're interviewing her and this woman's going, do you know, I was having sex and it was getting hotter and hotter and hotter and then it finished and she said it was still getting hotter and hotter and hotter and I went, oh shit, that's just fire. I mean, that was Elgar Street.
Oh, my God. My face is like a beater at the moment. It's just crazy.
Anyway, it neighbor's bed.
What an interview. You are gold.
Around that time, I was going to spiritual churches and I was into spirit guides. And this woman had drawn me a picture of and said, this is Maya, your spirit guide. I'd been to some spiritual church. So Maya hung on the wall above the kitchen in this flat. Anyway, somehow Maya had fallen and she really hung upside down because what had happened, the sticky tape had come down. So we walked into this flat with this eight-year-old who's just looking at this devastation, all her toys, and she went and got this picture of Maya and she said, here, Mummy, here's your spirit guide. We're
going to
be okay.
How beautiful.
Oh, so this was an eight-year-old, and I remember that moment so, so clearly.
You can see it in your eyes. It has a very emotional sort of connection to even
And
now,
I just thought, what did I, what, you know, I was off my face. What if the kids were there? What if, you know, and when I was a little girl, like I said, you know, with issues with fires, setting fire to my sister's bed, so I had nightmares from a kid. And I thought, what the hell? What if I was so out of it, I slept through this or the kids were there? Anyway, some guardian angels look after me because around that time I was having affairs with women. And the guy from the housing commission, the officer, hauls me into the office. He couldn't cope. He'd been getting drunk. Hauls me into the office and his manager is standing next to him. He is, you know, he's there and he's tapping away and he knew I'd been having affairs with women and men at the time.
Yeah.
And instead, my place is burnt down. And he's going, what's it like for you? Do you pick up those women in bars? Rah-de, rah-de, rah. And I looked at her and thought, is this guy insane? His boss is a lesbian. Anyway, because I thought I was getting kicked out. I'd been stoned. I'd had the boyfriend. So he's going on about me and women. She stands up and she says, Sandy, she said, what would you like? Would you like a three-bedroom terrace house?
And he said,
what? She said, I'll go and see what I can find for you. You know, it'd be nice if the girls had their own bedroom. And I'll have a look what's on the system. And he went to me, what the fuck just happened?
I just went. Oh, you just become a feminist queen, didn't you?
So she gave me, I got a place in Woolloomooloo, this great big three-bedroom
Wow.
Federation house. And Yeah, and I sort of turned my life around. My friends were going, some of them had started uni, and I thought, well, maybe I can do that. So I was working for home care for a while, and I saved up enough to do a university entrance course at New South Wales Uni. It was around 1990. I turned 30 around that stage.
Yep.
So I went to and did this course. And I got into social work, and I did a year of it, only 1 year, and I topped the course.
Wow.
And they people were saying, how are you doing that, handwriting your assignments? And a lot of it was common sense. And I started to remember that I had been very clever when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And I think didn't finish it, left Sydney, did a welfare diploma.
Okay. Now I know you talk about so many different things that you've done helping people within the system of corrective services and so on. So what are your degrees? Because you've got a book of tricks there, haven't you?
I've got a whole heap.
You do. Talk us through some of your degrees, because mate, you've really done well. You've done an amazing job.
Someone who completed 1 year of high school, I got a master's in adult ed, grad dip in writing, bachelor of education, associate diploma of welfare, and I've also studied art therapy. That's very recent.
And you're an author.
I'm an author. When corrective services booted me out, it's probably the best thing that ever happened.
How did you get into corrective? Like, you know,
with the juvenile record, you mean?
Well, I guess, but there's a massive gap there. I mean, for me, on the other hand, unfortunately, it just drags me around like a fucking anchor. But anyway, I can't get away from my past.
How did you
get a foot in the door? What was the starting point for you to work in incarcerated areas, I guess, or jails, prisons?
I got work in drug and alcohol first, the Department of Health. I was working in Moree, came back to Sydney, worked at Manly, Royal North Shore, in the needle exchanges, health education. So I was doing a lot of, that's when I did my Bachelor of Education and all of that, because I really loved adult ed, but it was focused around HIV and Hep C. And so I'm studying, working in a needle exchange, got, you know, the kids are getting in their teens. Then had another baby, split up, and I decided to go to Moree to work.
Was that your son at this stage? Is that the other child you had, your son? Yeah.
Yeah, he's in his 20s now, but I decided to go to Moree to work as a drug and alcohol counsellor, take the baby, rations it's over, wanted to get out of Sydney, girls of teens by then. Got other accommodation. So I went up to Moree and I worked as a drug and alcohol counsellor. I was up there about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half, burnt out incredibly badly and decided I had to leave and went to Katoomba. Well, Roythorne House was the Aboriginal rehab. And before I'd left, I'd started, God, I don't know how I did it. I finished my master's there, worked as a counsellor time, and I was training the Aboriginal work AOD workers in Cert 4 in Community Services AOD.
So as an educator?
Yeah, as a teacher.
Yep.
I came back to Sydney, went back up there and helped them, taught that course in Western Sydney, but that job was coming to an end. And I was in Katoomba and I'd seen jobs in prison for AOD workers and I didn't want to do it. But I saw, it was so funny, the Katoomba paper, it had life skill teacher at Parkley Correctional Centre. It was 2000. Mm. I was at the point I needed more work. Rang the number. Ironically got my future boss, which was a miracle because he usually had an afternoon nap. Yep. So he says, I rang him up and said, look, I don't know about this job. If it's cooking or budgeting, forget it. But I thought I'd find, I said, I realise it closes today. He said, you got any quals in education? I went, yeah, I got a master's and a bachelor. Oh, he said, what have you been doing? I said, well, I'm teaching a certificate in drug and alcohol. And I said, I've been up on the missions around Moree. And he said, hang on, you've got a master's in education. You've been teaching anger management and you've been working with Aboriginal communities. I went, yeah. He said, you're made for the job. Get your CV. And I said, I'm at work. I can't. He said, cover letter. And I went in and he said, the job's teaching anger management.
Yeah.
He said, it was like you were, and I was thinking, made to work in a men's prison.
Yeah.
So that's how it started, yeah.
Wow. And how many jails did you work in? Because you spent, let's just say how many years and how many jails?
Okay, that was 2000, and I lost my job, no other way, in 2015.
So 15 years.
So I was a teacher.
Sandy, that'll drive anyone in fucking sane. Working in jails, that's longer than a life sentence. You get 10 years for a life sentence back in the day. Yeah.
Well, it was. And, you know, sometimes I loved it. I mean, at Parkley, I was I did a primal screaming class with the guys in anger management. And It just so happened that a shiv had been found in the metal shop as I'm letting out I'm demonstrating my primal scream. They wanted to march me out of the jail. I came in. I wasn't allowed to teach. I used to get the guys to do the chicken dance I made up for my kids. So I'd get them up and dance in stress and anger management. Some governors, they were back then, loved it. Others wanted to escort me out of the jail. So Parkley, I was continually in trouble, but still, you know. So I had times where I loved it, then I hated it. I was in head office for years I went up to Grafton, you know, down to Berrima doing HIV and drug and alcohol ed for about 4 years.
I got to say, you would have been so respected though by the inmates in those centres. Yeah, I mean, as someone that's spent, you know, the best part of nearly 14 years incarcerated over a period of, you know, my life, I know, you know, the sort of people that you come across, and you would have had a lot of respect, because you could just see you've got that face where it just makes you feel warm and light up, and it's like, oh, I think I could actually talk to this lady, you know what I mean? She sounds all right. Or, you know, your personality, and they wouldn't have a clue of what you've actually gone through in your life and the traumas and you know, the things that you have. And I use this word very powerfully, because I'm a big advocate for any abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse survivors, as I am a survivor of, abuse, both physical and sexual, growing up. So, you know, it's funny. We with lived experience seem to do, and I'm not putting anyone down, and please, any of you listeners out there that may take this the wrong way, don't. It is what it is. But us with lived experience have so much fucking value in this world, and to be able to give back. And if the government could understand that, you know, our past could definitely save somebody's future. And, you know, I get it. There's some of us out there that just will never be reformed, or, you know, never choose to want to. Yeah, and there's a lot of people hurt and traumatized that just, you know, or addiction from, there's stories there, you know what I mean? Yeah. And just, not justification, I don't like to use that word, but reasoning to why that person could have been where they are today from where they originally started. I mean, you know, I made my choices. And my jail wasn't because I was abused. That was because I rebelled. But I didn't ask for the first, you know, quarter of my life to be dealt the cards I was dealt with. Nor did you, nor did any other survivor. You know, so I just think that, you know, you just have this amazing energy and this smile. I'm looking at, I'm glowing talking to you. It's been such an honour. It is. And I just think, you know, you really... still battling in there, like you said, with your own person and your own sort of, if I can use the word without being disrespectful, inner demons, you know.
Yeah.
And then you're out there still trying to give others hope, you know. That's very powerful. And that's an amazing story of redemption in my books.
Well, now my goal, okay, the book's done, so I've done that. I'm not going to write another one yet, but what I'm going to do...
I'm going to read your fucking book. How's that? Because I said I ain't going to read no one's book. I'm going to read your book. You've got me. I'm going to buy your book. Or if you send me a link, I'm going to get it. I will get it, okay?
Oh, thanks. I've had Yeah, really good feedback. People have
said I don't care. Don't want anyone's feedback. Don't need anyone's feedback. I've interviewed you. I know who you are now. I thoroughly appreciate you. And guess what? I am going to read your book. I really want to
keep you to that.
No, you can. You just need to send me the links. And for everyone out there that's listening, can you please give us where we can find the book? And once again, the book's name is titled Borderline. Yes.
Okay. Well, what I did with the publisher, I said, look, it has to come out as an e-book as well, because half the people I know can't afford to buy a paper book.
Yes.
I mean, that, you know, even $27, $30 is a lot of money to someone. So I said, put it on Amazon as an ebook. So it's about $9 there. You can buy it in some bookstores, but the best place to get it is through Bad Apple Press, because they send it out the next day. I think it's about $27 a paper book. But anyone who's experienced trauma-related dissociation, it's written from inside these states.
Yeah.
So, you know, and some of them are pretty wild, crazy. You know, they take you on a wild ride, and others are child state. So it's written in five different voices. And at first I thought, no publisher want this, but they actually really loved it, because I was able to write it because Jolie had died, and I was so grief-stricken that I could actually enter the space to write it, or it would have been a different book. But you laugh. People keep going, am I meant to be laughing?
Well, I've got to be honest, I didn't realise I would laugh so much interviewing you. Like,
yeah, thanks. And considering this morning, I didn't know I'd be doing this interview tonight. I
How good was that?
Really well, I went, wow.
Hey, everything happens for a reason. And I'm so stoked. I'm just so grateful. And I really would love to have you back on the show down the track, because I think there's more to your story. And I would love to share more. And because each of our guests on The Clink have such powerful stories of redemption, if you could put it into a word or a sentence or a paragraph, what would be your last statement on The Clink?
Tell your story. Write it. Use art. Use your body. But all our stories matter and important. And our personal stories are the history of our time. So unless we express it, it gets lost. So I would encourage others to just start writing, start using art, using any means you can, but record your story. Because when you're gone, your children and generations, this is history. We're part of history. So we're the ones who need to record it.
Sandy, Jessamine, would you write my book?
Ha no.
And on that note, I'm going to say thank you so much for being a guest on The Clink. You have been amazing. It's been an absolute honor, and I hope that everybody out there has thoroughly enjoyed this wonderful chat. Thank you very, very much, Sandy.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you very much, Sandy, for an absolutely amazing two-episode part here on season 4 of The Clink. This week is one that is absolutely going to blow your mind. Marie Barbaric.
Back in those days, the cars would come out and the workers would grab all the children that were that they could find, and they would remove them and put them into homes, etc. And nobody really wanted us. You know, you'd go into a home and they didn't know what to do with you. They didn't know how to treat you. It was scary days for me. I was a child, lost and angry, and being sexually assaulted constantly and beaten. And I had a baby, and I almost didn't get there. I mean, during that whole process, I had been suicidal the whole way, and had multiple times of attempting to kill myself. Yeah. I would have made it, except my youngest daughter turned around to her friend and said, "Something's wrong. Mum wouldn't do this.
She just felt within
she
herself.
She felt something was wrong, and she made her friend's mum take her home. And they found me just in time. It was literally just in time. And when I finally come to in the hospital, my kids were all standing around me, and they just looked at me and they said, "Don't you ever do that again, Mum. We love you and we need you." That's what saved me. My children saved me.
Don't miss this one. Coming to you on The Clink.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record, for the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, for the record.